Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Gail Seiler, and I'm your host for today. And later on, I'll be joined by a co-host, Susan Franson, who will lead us through one of the later stories. And we have a great show for our listeners. Many regular Friday listeners may be waiting for the weekly news roundup with Dennis Hart. But as we mentioned last Friday, Dennis is currently en route to California. But his news roundup will be back next week when he will start sending it to us from sunny California. A little later, we'll be hearing from Bernard McDonald, who is an associate professor of music at Simpson College, and also will be directing the Central Iowa Symphony, and we're going to be talking to him about that performance. And in the last part of the show, Susan Guiazda from the City of Ames will join us to fill us in on happenings around Ames. But first, we turn our attention to Puerto Rico. As all of you know, Puerto Rico has been hit by two very strong hurricanes in the past few weeks. First, Hurricane Irma, and then, with hardly enough time to recover from that, they were hit by Hurricane Maria. The devastation has been described as extreme, particularly damage to infrastructure like electricity, water, and cell phone coverage. I was a long way from Puerto Rico, so it's easy to forget about what's happening there. But we have people with us now who can give us a more informed and personal view of what's going on and what people are experiencing in Puerto Rico. We have Megan Myers, an assistant professor of Spanish and a faculty member in the Latino-Latina Studies Program in the Department of World Languages and Culture at ISU. That's a big title.
It is, yeah. Thanks for saying it all.
Thank you for being here. And her specialty is the Caribbean, so
yes.
So welcome.
Thanks.
And we have several students with us that we're going to be talking with also. We have Luis Gonzalez.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Laura Valderrama.
Thanks for having us.
And Ashley Steen.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being here on this rainy day. So, Dr. Myers, let's start with you. When the devastation of Puerto Rico after the hurricanes came to light, the New York Times reported that nearly half of Americans don't know Puerto Ricans are fellow citizens, which was kind of surprising. So can you tell us, explain what is the status of Puerto Rico and of the people who live there?
Yeah, sure. I'm going to do this. So kind of hit on three specific historical moments to kind of frame this. Students here, feel free to help me out or add anything in. But I'll start with 1898. So this is following the Spanish-American War. And when they signed the Treaty of Paris, when this war ends, it makes three possessions previously of Spain fall into U.S. possessions. And these three are Guam, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico, right, in 1898 with the Treaty of Paris. And then following that, just 2 years later, we have the Foraker Act, which is in 1900, and this makes Puerto Rico essentially it makes official this territory status. So it moves Puerto Rico from a military government to a civilian government. And I think the most important, and we're talking about the citizenship of Puerto Ricans, right, is the 1917 Jones Act, also known as the Jones Act of Puerto Rico. It has some different names, but the Jones Act of 1917 is what formally makes Puerto Ricans United States citizens. So it was retroactive. So anyone born after 1898 became U.S. citizens with the 1917 Jones Act. And what's interesting here, if we think about what rights kind of the 1917 Jones Act gave to Puerto Rican citizens, is that one of these things was that they were able to elect a Puerto Rican resident commissioner. So this means that Puerto Ricans are able to elect, you know, a voice for their community, but that this individual has no voice in the House of Representatives.
And just to go back even a little bit farther, before that, Puerto Rico was a colony of Spain?
Exactly. Yep, correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so was there a time period between when they gained freedom from Spain to when the U.S., I'll say, took over, that they were free, they were independent?
So, I mean, there's different ways to look at that. For the most part, when the Spanish-American War ends, right, they pass from a Spanish colony, right, in 1898 to being a U.S., under a military government in the U.S., really we would consider already a U.S. territory,
okay,
right, if we want to use that term there. Okay. So, you know, some of the issues, and we might talk about this a little bit later, but sometimes Puerto Rico is still framed as a colony, right? And that was one of the most recent issues on the referendum vote, right, the plebiscite vote, that it was still framed using that language of Puerto Rico as a colony.
Sometimes areas that have been territories have become states. That seemed to be the trend with Hawaii and Alaska, but that isn't automatic.
It's not. And that, I think, is really interesting. Maybe you guys could speak to this vote in Puerto Rico, what the reality of it is, right, this referendum status vote. But essentially, in after, you know, post-1898 with the Treaty of Paris, Guam, Philippines, Puerto Rico, these were all seen by the United States. And this also has to do with the ideas of manifest destiny, right? They were seen as colonial possessions, not as territories that might be later converted into states, as you know, previously had happened in United States history. So something when we talk about these different political statuses or possible options to Puerto Rico, they talk a lot about this referendum status vote. And maybe you all can speak to the most recent one in 2017, right? But what happened was you had three options, correct? And you guys are all of voting age, right? So the three options were to continue with the Commonwealth status, right? Statehood and independence. And you all probably know it won by essentially a landslide.
Yeah. But there was like not a lot of people who voted. It was like a really small percentage of
exactly.
It. So it wasn't like, I don't know if it was really actually like relevant to like what really people want.
Approximately 30% of people only went out to vote. So
yes.
I don't know if you can count that as like a referendum since like most of the Puerto Rican population didn't participate in the plebiscite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. So statehood won by 97%, right? Or won 97% of the votes. But what's interesting is that these 97% of the votes accounted for actually less votes than statehood had in the previous vote, right? In 2012. So I think you're right. Less than like 24% of the population voted. And this was due to, for the most part, some boycotts of parties that were pro-independence, right, or other parties because of some language used on the ballot that they disagreed with for the most part. The other interesting thing is that even though statehood won, and some pro-statehood parties obviously were very pleased, including the governor, right, Congress is not binded to make any move.
Mm-hmm. And Congress is the body that has to decide on statehood.
Yeah. Correct.
So people who are Puerto Ricans, they're U.S. citizens, they're free to move from the mainland back to the island, yes. But people always wonder, what is it about presidential elections? Can they vote in that?
If you are like in the island of Puerto Rico, you actually cannot vote for the president. You can vote for the presidential candidate, but you can't vote. However, if you are in the states, and if you have been like a resident for like a year, you can. And that's like I was able to vote because I was here, but my parents and like my sister weren't because they were back home in the island.
You don't even need a year. As long as you established residency, that qualifies you to vote.
That's so interesting.
And interesting, too, I think, because I'm going to give approximate numbers, but Puerto Ricans on the island, right, it's about 3.5 million. And Puerto Ricans or Hispanics of Puerto Rican descent living in the United States, mainland is about more like 5. So there are more actually living in the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
That likely would have access to voting
to
in
voting.
The election.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's turn to talking about the hurricanes that hit there. And all three of our students were living in Puerto Rico before you came to ISU. So you are only here in Iowa a few years and still have all your family and so on back there. So tell us what it was like for each of you. I know that it must have been hard to find out how your relatives were and so on. So can you give us some information on that? Luis, do you want to start?
Yeah. At least in my part, it was really frustrating because, like, I didn't have communication, like, with my family because, like, all the communications were down. So I feel like that time period that I didn't know how they were, like, obviously you have faith that they're okay, but, like, you actually never know, and that's really frustrating. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I feel like that moment when I was able to contact them about, like, 3 days after, like, it hit, it was, like, a really sentimental moment for me because, like, I didn't know where they were or, like, what was happening. And, like, when they told me, like, all the, like, devastation that was happening, all the flooding, so, like, property damages, people that, like, are literally, like, died, it was devastating, honestly.
And do they live, what area do they live in? Do they live in a city?
Yeah, my family lived in San Juan and Guaynabo, which is close to the capital. Mm-hmm. And at least my father's apartment, like we lived in a 16th floor and the hurricane, like that was like all the walls like were torn down. Like they had to rebuild it. Like there's no way he can live there. So,
did he go to a shelter or did he try during the hurricane?
He actually left for Florida to go with his sister because, like, he didn't have a choice.
Ashley?
So, basically, my parents moved to Florida with me. So I basically went to Iowa and they went to Florida. But the most of my family, my grandparents, my aunts, uncles, cousins, all those extended families, they live in Jawaguan, Umacao. So that's the south area of the island. And that's actually where the hurricane actually came through. So since my family lives in the rural area, we didn't know about them for, like, I think 5 or 6 days. And we didn't have direct contact with them. So it was just a stranger called my mom and told her that she did see them, and that's basically it. So we didn't have contact with them at all. Just a couple of days ago, actually, we actually were able to talk to an aunt, but it's just because they drove up to the capital, San Juan, because that's where all the signal really is. But before that, we didn't know anything. And yeah, their house is devastated, destroyed. Luckily, we had pictures from a news station over there that took pictures of the house, but that's all we know, basically. They're basically just living in the house altogether, and my grandmother had to go to a shelter as well because that area is just completely destroyed.
And that must have been so stressful for you to have to wait all that time to find out if they were actually okay or where they were or how they were.
Yeah, it was especially stressful because my grandmother is, she's like 93, I believe. So it's really difficult and she can't really move on her own. So we need a lot of help with my aunts and uncles to actually help her. So we were just really worried about her. Obviously, we were hopeful that she was going to be fine. And they are fine right now. But as you all know, I'm pretty sure supplies are just taking really long to get there. And not only that, supplies usually go to the capital. And the capital is getting great attention from everyone, but not the rural areas. And that's the areas that actually do need a lot of help. And some areas, they haven't even gotten to those areas because there's no way to actually get to them.
Because roads are destroyed.
Exactly,
and,
blocked. And the signal is just bad.
And you can't, communication is difficult.
For me, it was actually really hard too because I wasn't able to talk to my mom or like anyone for like 2 weeks, and I actually knew about her last week. I wasn't able to contact her directly. She was able to talk to my sister, but I just couldn't get a hold of her, and that was really frustrating because you go from talking to a person like every day, basically 2 times a day sometimes, and then you don't know about them, and you know you hope that they're fine. You know that they're fine, but you just want that reassurance that they're actually okay. And actually, we haven't been able to talk that much just because the communications are so bad. And she lives in the West Coast, and it wasn't impacted as much as I would say, like, the East Coast or the Southeast. But she still says, like, she sent me an email yesterday, and she's like, oh, it's been such a hard time because I'm really stressed, even though, like, this comes from a person who has a stable job. She's on the West Coast. I can't imagine people who are actually don't know where their families are or anything. And she's just like, it's been really stressful, and the crisis is like really big. So I don't know if people measure that, like how big of a crisis this thing is.
Yeah, as I said, it's easy to be removed from it and not really be aware of how it's impacting people there and people here who are connected to those folks. Have you found places at ISU to come together as students impacted by this? Have you gotten some comfort or assistance from just being able to talk with other students who are experiencing similar things with their families?
Luckily, I came to ISU with my friend Ashley. We graduated together from high school, so we're each other's support system here at ISU. But other than that, there's Iowa State University Puerto Rican Association, and they've definitely been updating us on like what's happening on the island as far as they know. And they've been posting different like positive messages on like social media and all that. And I posted also like a solidarity message that like if someone needs to contact me, if someone just needs like a hug, they can like message me because like I'm always like available. And so yeah, I feel like when Puerto Ricans face a crisis, they bond, they get together and get through it together.
Definitely. I would add to that I think you can see that also, like, in the island from the small, like, news that we can see, like, people are so resilient back home, and they have so much faith. Like, they know that even though we are facing a crisis, we will build from that. And I think, like, a lot of Puerto Ricans have come together, like, here at ISU, and it's been really helpful to, like, just go through that process. And even non-Puerto Ricans, they always, like, how's your family? And, like, mm-hmm. my professors are always, like, really aware of, like, what's going on. So that's been really helpful.
And now that this makes me think of you, because just last or 2 weekends ago, maybe we mm-hmm. volunteered at the Latino Heritage Festival in Des Moines, and yeah. you ran into another Puerto Rican there, right,
yeah.
who was an organizer, who was from Aguadilla. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it was nice even how that sense of community was built, right? And
yeah.
she told you, I just heard from, you know, I heard from someone yesterday when you still hadn't heard from anyone, who yeah. said everyone was okay there, right?
Yeah, and that always helps to, like, just know that at least their family is doing okay, too.
Yeah, those lines of communication through whatever means they can be established must be so valuable. Do you have a sense of what people there think about the response? Do you have a sense of whether people think the response, especially from the federal government, has been adequate or not? Maybe those aren't conversations you've had with the limited ability you've had to communicate with them. But do you have any sense of that?
I believe that they don't think it's been as good as it could get. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we haven't been able to communicate with them as much as we can. But even seeing, like, kind of the mayor of San Juan talk about the supplies that have been given, or just the publicity it's been getting, it's not enough. And I feel like Puerto Ricans do deserve a little bit more validation, because we are American citizens, too. And sometimes we feel like people don't treat us that way, as well as FEMA. Apparently, some people were getting things that weren't actually good enough to eat. For example, someone said that they received a box of ketchup or mayonnaise, and you can't really survive with condiments. So it's not things that you can actually eat or survive from, and we need that.
And I heard that they're telling people to sign up for FEMA relief on the internet. But people don't have access to, I mean, it's laughable, but yeah. I heard that from several different news sources. So it seems like there's a disconnect between the on-the-ground reality and some of the messages that are coming from the government. And we have heard a great deal recently about the economic situation in Puerto Rico. Maybe, Dr. Meyer, is there some background you can give us that helps us understand how Puerto Rico got in these bad economic straits that now have been compounded by the hurricanes?
Yeah, you know, I'm not an economist, but I can kind of explain to you how I understand it, at least in some, a little bit of historical background. I think there are a lot of factors that have contributed to the crisis, the economic crisis and the recession in Puerto Rico. You know, if I'm kind of trying to think of three, it would be a collapsed economic model, this overuse and maybe misuse of debt issuance, and also limited tax revenue collection. So if we're looking kind of historically, look back about 50, 60 years, I would probably explain a little bit about Operation Bootstrap, right? And in the mid-century, starting 1947, 1950s, these tax incentives and tax breaks for manufacturing or industrialization, essentially, in Puerto Rico, right? So are there these really lucrative tax breaks. And we have, during this time, a lot of U.S. manufacturing companies, right, for the most part establishing their factories and their workplaces in San Juan, right, kind of in the outskirts. You can still see that community today, right, if you're outside of the capital, which looks very run down now, correct?
Mm-hmm. So companies from the mainland were taking advantage of those tax breaks,
sure, exactly,
and moved their operations.
These tax incentives, there. Correct. And then when they realize it's actually taking a burden on the U.S. Treasury in 1996, I believe President Clinton signs a bill that begins this phase-out program that lasts for 10 years to phase it out. So by 2006, these tax incentives and tax breaks no longer exist. And I think this is when you first really begin to see this economic model that previously existed, right, this manufacturing economy kind of have to shift and rebalance, maybe search for a new model. And this is when you see the debt begin to rise, unemployment rates begin to rise, right? I think the unemployment rate in Puerto Rico is about 2 to 3 times greater than it is in any U.S. state. And I think these numbers, we really started to see them rise post 96, 2006, in this 10-year period of the phase out. But maybe y'all could speak to this. A lot of people think that sometimes the current economic situation in Puerto Rico is linked to this uncertain political status, right? That maybe Puerto Rico would be better served if we knew, what the future might hold as far as the political status, right? Will it continue as a commonwealth, right?
Some of President Trump's comments have been to the effect that the economic situation that Puerto Rico is in is kind of their own making. But when we understand it in terms of past policy and even probably going back farther than that, we see it differently. So how do people react when they hear the president saying things like that, like kind of blaming Puerto Rico for their economic problems?
And my family's opinion is that it's kind of like incredible because like the U.S. has like a lot of regulations on Puerto Rico regarding trade. We can't trade with like other countries. Mm-hmm. It has to like we have to trade with like the United States only and use their like ships and all that, mm-hmm. obviously to like conserve commerce in the mainland. But that's to our detriment because like we can't trade with other countries, and a lot of agricultural land that we could potentially use to like cultivate like sugar like we used to and like coffee. So we can trade with other countries. We can't use it because, like, what's the point? We can't even trade with them.
Is that the Jones – part of the Jones Act that mm-hmm. is comes
Correct.
Into play
yep.
there?
Yeah. So some would say that, you know, that Puerto Rico had more autonomy as far as foreign relations and exports prior to becoming a U.S. territory. But I think – I mean, the one quote I think about of President Trump's is when recently he said that in relation to – or speaking about the debt, that we'll have to wipe that out. And I think it was really unclear, right, these words. So how would you go about wiping it out? Because Puerto Rico can't even file for bankruptcy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So they can do a similar process, and they started to do that this past summer, right, in May, I believe. But both President Trump and Paul Ryan have made it really clear that there will be no taxpayer-funded bailout for Puerto Rico. So, you know, these kind of comments. I think it's, for the most part, really unclear and maybe mm-hmm. confusing what his plan might be if there is one at all.
Definitely, because it's always like an unclear like question mark. Like, oh yeah, like what's going to happen? Like, what's the plan? And like, I feel even though yes, we do have to fix that debt right now, the main focus should be in providing those supplies to those people and providing help that is needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's also really difficult because since there is that huge debt, I feel like we're just so tied into that mm-hmm. that even when Trump was talking in his tweets, he says, yeah, Puerto Rico is in a crisis, but it's also in debt. And I feel like it shouldn't go hand in hand because mm-hmm. if we need help, we should have the help we deserve as well.
It's difficult when people's lives and safety and well-being is tied up with political statements and so mm-hmm. on. That makes it difficult. Are you in better communication with your families there now? And are you feeling better that they're at least on the road to improving their situation?
Well, I've been able to contact my family at least once a day, but, like, it's just because they can, like, go to public places that have, like, Wi-Fi, like, commercial centers that, like, offer Wi-Fi for, like, people that, like, don't have signal. But it's just because of that, because, like, if they were at home, I couldn't contact them. So I had to make sure to, like, the day before, like, tell them, oh, what time are you going to be at that place so, like, I can call you at this time.
Sometimes, like, for me at least, I can't directly communicate with them. They have to call me. And it's really stressful because you don't want to be paying attention to your phone all the time, but you know you have to be now because you might miss that call and you don't want to miss that call. So that's, like, really hard. And I haven't been able to, like, communicate with my dad or my other family or friends just because they have to, like, for example, my mom has to go to, like, some place that has Wi-Fi, but it's fairly dangerous. So she's like, I can't go there every day because I don't know what might happen. So I will have to call you sometime, and you just have to, like, be there to pick up that call.
For me, I haven't been able to contact them directly because they just contact kind of just aunts and people that can actually help. So I haven't actually heard my cousins or my aunts or uncles. So I'm just kind of relying on my mom's word. But as I said, at least in the South area, it's still really destroyed, and they don't have signal. So all the time that they actually do talk to my mom, they have to drive up to the Capitol to actually be able to talk. But right now, I feel hopeful with all of the publicity that Puerto Rico is getting, but I know that we can still do much more than what's being done. Also, my family is still basically uncommunicated and don't have enough supplies. So basically what my family is doing is just getting a lot of supplies and making them get there. Because even though time has passed, the crisis is still horrible there. So mm-hmm. we can't let Puerto Rico out of the spotlight. because it still needs the help.
So your relatives that are in the U.S. are gathering supplies and sending
them exactly.
directly. Which brings me to my next question, which was, are there organizations that we can let people know about that would be good places to donate and good ways to contribute and to try to help?
Yeah, I can mention two that come to mind first for me. The first is UNICEF, that has a really reputable relief fund. And also the Hispanic Federation has a relief fund called Unidos, or, you know, Together or United, that was also been very successful thus far. And I should also wanted to mention on ISU's campus, and Laura, I want you to mention your drive as well, but a relief fund, but World Languages and Cultures, the department, all of next week we have a drive to collect non-perishable food items, other things such as toiletries, insect repellent, batteries. We'll be collecting those from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. right in the main office, third floor of Pearson of World Languages and Cultures. We'll be shipping them by next weekend.
Yeah, and also the Iowa State Puerto Rican Student Association is doing a supply drive. We're doing that, I believe it's next Tuesday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., and that will be in front of Curtis Hall and Central Campus.
This has been so enlightening. Thank you so much for coming in to tell us about it, both the historical perspective and also the personal experiences. Mm-hmm. And our hearts go out to you all, because I know it must be stressful to try to be good students and taking exams and writing papers when this is going on. Mm-hmm. So we commend you for that, but thanks for coming and speaking about your home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, thank you so much.
Next on our program is Bernard McDonald, professor of music at Simpson College, who will be conducting for Central Iowa Symphony's first concert of the season, Worlds Lost and Found. Welcome, Professor McDonald.
Thank you very much. Good morning to you.
I hope the brief selection we played during the transition entices our listeners to hear much more in the live performance tomorrow. Can you tell us a little about this piece and why you selected it for this concert?
Well, these beautiful songs by Mahler are not so often performed, and they have a very special kind of intimate beauty that is that takes us into a world, I think, of a somewhat introspective world of the life of the artist. Mahler was a fan of Friedrich Rückert. He was one of his favorite poets, and he set these five songs to music around about 1905, and he orchestrated them almost immediately. They were originally written for piano and voice, and they work very well with piano and voice, but it seems to me, having played them, that it was inevitable that he would set them for orchestra. And although the song as a set are scored for a fairly large orchestra, every single song is actually really set for an individual chamber orchestra. So they all have very different orchestrations. Not the whole orchestra plays in each song. So there's a softness to some of them that it's an extraordinarily intimate one. And the one I just heard the tail end of, Liebst du um Schönheit, love for beauty, love for beauty's sake, is in some ways the most conventional song, and I mean that in a positive way. The others, in some ways, are a little bit more esoteric, and they are exceptionally beautiful, and I think the poetry is quite spare. Mahler was drawn to Rückert's world of Rückert himself was quite interesting. He was an Orientalist and a very literary man, and his poetry is in this instance particularly is economical, and so I hope I believe that our audience tomorrow evening they're in for a rare treat and a contemplative experience with the Mahler songs.
Thank you, and I expect this is an introduction to many of the people who will be at the concert, if not most, because I would be surprised if this has been performed here before, even during the International Orchestra Festival, because it's like a concerto for voice, a little bit. Is that?
And in a sense, in a sense, there's one aspect of it that's like chamber music in some way. The biggest, most dramatic song is Um Mitternacht, which calls for most of the brass section. But the voice part acts. The orchestra for the different songs has different purposes, and sometimes the orchestra accompanies and provides a kind of soundtrack, as it were, of the content of the songs. And in other cases, the singer seems to be having almost a very intimate dialogue with solo instruments. It's definitely has a chamber music feel in some ways. And the singer is required, in this instance, certainly, to have impeccable technique and able to be, in a sense, the singer's totally in the foreground because she has the words and these melodies. But she also acts in concert with these individual orchestral voices. And I think that's a special experience, I think, for our players in the Central Iowa Symphony, because they have to respond very empathetically to the human voice, and I appreciate their curiosity and their desire to do that. It also requires an ability to play very quietly. Sometimes the singer is asked to sing very, very quietly, and then the orchestra's job is to match that kind of dynamic. So it's also a good opportunity for the orchestral players to try something out that requires quite a high degree of technical control.
Well, thank you. I think you have given our audience a real preview of the behind-the-scenes sensitivity for this piece. Could you just tell us what the entire program is for the concert?
Sure. We're opening with the overture to Les Vespres Siciliennes, the Sicilian Vespers, by Verdi. That will be followed by the Rukert Lieder of Mahler that we've just been talking about. And after the intermission, we will play Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, the Pastoral.
So you have balanced the rare listening experience with probably one of the pieces that most of the audience has heard most often over the years.
Right. Yes, the Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony is a perennial favorite, you might say, and it's a piece that I've loved since I was very young, and I think there's something about this idealistic love of the countryside that appeals to certainly appealed to me as a very young young man, as a teenager, and so I think it appeals to young people of all ages, this portrait of the country. So I'm looking forward to sharing that with the audience too.
And the Verdi, could you say just a couple of words? We have just a little bit of time left. Can you say, tell us about the Verdi?
Yes. The opera from which this is drawn, this is the overture, is not that often performed, but the overture is a fabulous concert piece. It manages to, in a sense, capture some of the drama of the opera, and it distills a certain kind of... I read somewhere that it's a really good trailer for the opera in the style of a movie trailer. It starts off with this kind of ominous introduction, and then it bursts into some different versions of the opera's three main themes. And it's a fantastic orchestral showpiece, very hard to play, deceptively difficult, I think. It's a terrific opener, great orchestral showpiece, and I think the orchestra had great fun playing it.
Well, I'm sure the audience will have fun listening to it. This sounds like a really wonderful concert to stretch our listening. The world's lost and found, I think, probably will find some worlds when we come to your concert. And I wish we had time to talk a little about you, because I think we're also extraordinarily fortunate that you're here to conduct this. You have conducted orchestras at three continents. And so we'll just end with that. It should be an interesting and very enjoyable evening. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Susan.
Yes, we were wrapped up enough in the music. It's tomorrow night.
Okay.
7:30. And there is a little something at 6:45 that we didn't get around to mentioning. There's a little time to discuss. It's just the kind of things that we just started to discuss here.
Yeah.
So the audience will have a little introduction to the world's lost.
Okay.
Or that they're going to find.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And we now have Susan Guiazda in the studio with us. Susan is the public relations officer for the City of Ames, and we're glad to have you here for your monthly update on all things folks need to know in Ames. And you're going to be one of the things you're going to be talking about is the solar initiative. So you brought a guest.
I did. Good morning.
Hi.
It's always great to be here. Once again, October is a month filled with all sorts of activities, and I brought with me Donald Kamm, who is the director of Ames Electric Services. He's going to talk a little bit about a really exciting initiative we have in renewable energy, the SunSmart Ames Community Solar Project. But before we get into that, okay, I just want to make sure, because that's so exciting, I just want to make sure that I get through a few calendar items, because these are popular events that I know people won't want to miss. The big one is it seems like fall these last few days, and the leaves are definitely coming off the trees. So if you've been out doing your yard work, you're probably wondering when are Yardways Free Days. They are listed on our website at cityofames.org, but just, you know, for those of you who have your pencils handy, let me give you those dates. Those are October 21st, November 4th, November 18th, which includes brush, November 18th, and December 2nd. Those will be held at Chamness Technology at 400 Friel Drive. That is the same location as last year, but it is on the east side of town. It is not the south side location that people might be familiar with. It is on the east side of town.
So that's the location that we used in spring.
It is, absolutely.
And you've got 4 days. Do you always four have
days.
Four?
Four okay. days in the fall,
okay.
one day in the spring.
Okay. I know I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, those dates were selected so they do not conflict with football game, home football game
Perfect.
Dates. It is pretty tricky to get that. We also try to spread them out because we've had some unusual falls where we still have leaves
yeah.
on the trees at the end of November.
This might be a late one this year.
Yes.
I actually have a question. I have bags of acorns. My oak tree produced so many acorns this year. Can I bring those?
You know, that is a good question
okay,
for Chamness
Technology. I may have to call.
We contract with them, and okay. then users are obligated to follow their use
okay.
rules for yard waste.
I will check with them.
Disposal. So those are, you know, really important. Again, if you forget those, they're located on our website, cityofames.org. A fun event coming up on Saturday, October 14th, is the Fire Station Open House. That's located at Fire Station Number 1 on 13th and Burnett. From 9 a.m. to noon, come in, take a tour of the firehouse, learn a little bit more about fire equipment and fire safety, say hello to Freddie the fire truck, and meet all our firefighters. They are eager to share with you the message of fire safety. Fall is the time of year that we really encourage people to be aware of some of the dangers that come with the colder weather.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more outdoor recreational fires, a lot more indoor heating. Carbon monoxide, always an issue. So lots of different issues surrounding fire safety. And this open house, which is now in its fifth year, which even surprised me. I can't believe this is the fifth time we've done it, is very popular. We hope for great weather, and there'll be things inside and out if the weather holds up to look at the fire equipment and to really get that opportunity to talk to firefighters just up and close and personal. So we're looking forward to that event.
Sounds fun, like a family event.
Yeah, it is a family event. And another family event, actually, is the Ames Municipal Airport has gone through a huge modernization, which started with the new airport hangar. And that we cut a ribbon on that several months ago. And now we have a new municipal airport terminal. Very exciting for those who are interested in private aircraft and aviation, which is a much bigger audience than I ever realized before. And Iowa State University does funnel a lot of students to the Ames Municipal Airport for flying lessons. The airport is it's just a whole new world to go out there and see the different aircraft coming in and leaving. It's not a commercial airport, but there is a lot of private aircraft, more than you would think. And I guess if you think about it, we do see a lot of smaller planes flying around the city, and it never occurred to me where they were landing and taking off from, but the Ames Municipal Airport stays very busy. We have a terminal ribbon cutting. So the new terminal is open, and the ribbon cutting is scheduled from 9 to 11 a.m. on Saturday, October 21st. There'll be the opportunity to take a little tour around the facility, to grab a cup of coffee and maybe a donut, to listen to a brief program at 9:30 where some of the funders and people involved in the development of the terminal will speak, and then we'll cut the ribbon. So very, very fun Saturday morning event.
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot of things going on out at the airport that it seems more recently than
yeah.
than
a lot more
than
attention. It wasn't really something that I had given a lot of thought to,
yeah.
but I've been out there a lot and really impressed at the university connection with the airport, of the business community, and of course the ISU Research Park is right out there. What a real gem this is for our community, and how helpful it is for those who really rely on that kind of transportation to get around. We talk a lot about multimodal transportation, but mm-hmm. you don't really think about the ability that some people actually do use planes quite a bit to get their business done, and the time element involved there, where you can travel quickly and get to a lot of places. It's important for our community to have that asset available. And the new terminal really is a beautiful welcoming mat to the community. When you come into Ames now and walk through that terminal, there's this strong sense of this contemporary modern feel, and it's a really positive first impression.
Very cool.
So right. I didn't want to take up all the time because okay. Don is so patiently waiting. We have this really exciting opportunity for residents. I'll let Don talk about that.
All right.
Well, interestingly enough, since about 2013, people have been installing solar panels on their homes. And in the last year or so, others have come and said, well, I don't own a home. I'm a renter. My roof isn't capable of handling it. I want to get involved in solar. How can I add solar to my energy portfolio? How can I serve my home or business with solar? And so about a year ago, we started studying this. And I think the answer that we've developed, we call it SunSmart Ames. It's a community solar project where we go out, we find some city land, and we build a large solar panel. I'm talking a really large, like 7 acres worth of solar panels. We take this energy and then share it with anybody that wants to participate in the project. So it's kind of a, well, I'd like to have a piece for my home, so you can buy what we call power packs. And that's the name. It's a part of a panel. And then every month as that panel or as the whole system produces energy, we share that energy on a prorated basis with everybody that's bought a power pack. And this is something that we'd still like to construct probably in the next 3 to 6 months. We have the land already designated. It's going to be, interestingly enough, down by the airport. So there's some land, if you know where Sam's Club and that area is, we've got some land set up. And right now we're in that mode where we're talking to people, one-on-one, small groups, or we'll talk to the entire city about what the project is, where we're building it, and what people can do to participate.
So let me see if I understand this. So your electrical account would be linked with, if you buy into this, would kind of be linked with this solar array.
Yes, it's even easier than that. So okay. If you buy a power pack,
right.
Okay, I've already bought a power pack, so I'm waiting to get this thing built.
Do I get to like name it and decorate it or
let's think about that.
We will put your name on the website.
Or put your initials in the corner of the panel. I'm
okay.
not sure. But so then what happens is, so you buy this power pack. And then every month as the energy is generated, we put a credit on your energy bill. And this is a credit that will last for 20 years. So every month you will have a portion of that energy that will offset your bill. Now, one power pack doesn't provide a lot. It's about 2.5% to 3% of your energy. But what it does do is it locks in that price. So if our rates go up over the next 20 years, which mm-hmm. they probably will, mm. your power pack will give you that constantly priced energy. So okay. it's always there. You've already paid for it, and that's why you get that credit on the bill for the next 20 years.
And – but you're – so there's economic benefits, but I think people are also doing it because they believe that we need to be investing in solar energy as a society.
Yep.
Is that, would you say
yeah,
yes?
Yeah, I think we would encourage people not to do it for the return on investment mm-hmm. because you have to be in there for the 20 years
right.
if you really want your return.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. But what we're hearing from people is we want access to renewable energy mm-hmm. and it's not for what we can make. It's mm-hmm. that we feel committed.
It's what we should do.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is obviously a sustainable resource. And this is on top of the wind energy. Many people don't know. We have about 15% of our energy provided by wind turbines that we have under contract.
Mm-hmm.
And those are for 20 years. We also have refuse-derived fuel. We've been burning the county's garbage for over 40 years. So we have a lot of renewables within our energy mix. And this is the next one.
So can people buy more than one pack?
Oh, absolutely.
And do you think people will do that, or are people doing that?
They have.
We have. We've mm-hmm. seen 10. I think there was one person that wanted to buy 20 power packs. And so, yeah, you have the capability to buy one or really
so
as many as you want.
We don't have the power pack price exact yet, but we do believe it will be under $350.
Okay.
Well, I have a question.
Sure.
I live outside Ames, so okay. I don't get Ames Municipal electricity. Now, could I buy a power pack and donate it to, say,
the radio station?
That's an excellent idea. You bet. Interestingly, at some of our early meetings, we had people showing up from Boone and Nevada saying, well, I want to participate. And I said, unfortunately, because of the way we return it, it's returned as a credit on your energy bill, so you have to be an electric customer. But there's nothing stopping you for buying it for KHOI or, you know, or any other nonprofit, your church or any other program, or if you have a business, you know, in town. Really, that energy can be assigned to any electrical account in the city.
And what happens if you move, like if you leave
the
area?
Excellent question. If you move, we have several different – when we talked to our focus group and we said, what would you like to be done? Some have said, I'd like to leave it with my house. It would be a great sales idea 10 years from now that part of the house's energy. So I think we have that set up. If you want to donate it 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the road, you can donate it then. The city has also developed a way where we will purchase it back from you at a discounted rate.
So there's a depreciation
like
chart.
Like a prorated.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. And a number of groups were involved with the city. So this is really a very interesting collaborative process in planning and getting this to come to fruition. Is that correct?
We have a very strong group of people that would really like to see sustainability expanded. And we've met with them both as a focus group and as workshops, hearing from everybody.
And we have a UREB, our advisory board, that does speak on behalf of the residents that they come in contact with. Yep. So our and what's UREB stand for?
Oh, Electric Utility Operating and Review Advisory Board.
Made up of citizens that are appointed by the mayor, and they have been really active in this project. I'm very excited by it and helping to spread the message. We are helping to get people to sign up this month. This is the month.
This
and
the
there's an easy, easy way to sign up.
Yeah. Part of what we're doing, so we're talking to two final developers on who will build it. That's what's making the price a little bit flexible there. One is offering a better price but less energy. One's offering a little bit higher price but more energy. So we're looking at that. On the other side then is before we want to give the developer the go-ahead to go in there and build, we want to make sure that we have that grassroots effort where we've got about 80% of it spoken for. We're not even collecting money right now. We just want to hear from people that are interested.
Okay.
Once we have about 80% signed up, we'll then go into City Council. We'll present both the contract and the program. City Council then will talk about it, approve it, and then we'll be going out and starting to collect money and get the project to start building. So we want to get to that 80%.
Okay.
That's kind of the floor before we start getting the wheels moving.
So the commitment is easy.
Commitment's easy. I mean, if you got your city side from your electric bill, there is a page in there that it talks all about it. I think it's the third page, if I'm counting right.
Yes.
Read through it, and at the bottom, there's a little form. You can fill out the form and mail it to us. You can fill out the form and bring it in. You can go online.
It's one of the most popular ways.
Yep.
We have cityofames.org/solar, a fillable form.
Yep.
It is your commitment. There is no outlay of money at this point till we have that nailed down.
Absolutely.
But that commitment, that's helping to gather that 80% that we need to get going.
That's right. And some people have called Steve Wilson, the energy guy, and said, I want to buy one of these power packs, but how do I do it? And Steve will work with you on the phone, and his number is 239-5177. So we have a team of people taking your phone calls. It kind of sounds like we're all sitting there waiting. But
call now.
Yes. And if you have groups that want to hear more about this, please call Steve Wilson at 239-5177.
We'll set up speakers.
You bet.
We'll send you speakers.
I'm going out on Sunday to a church group and going to meet with them and talk about this to the parishioners of the church. So if there are any programs out there, we'd be happy to come out.
What's that website again?
It's www.cityofames.org/solar. Very good.
S-O-L-A-R. Great. Okay, so people who are interested in supporting this need to jump on the bandwagon.
Absolutely.
Right now.
October is the month.
And it's people and businesses. We've had several call up, say that they'd want some. So.
Okay. Thank you very much, both of you. I love the energy this early in the morning. Get it? The pun? Energy. Solar energy. Thank you both for being here. And we'll put the links for that on our website so people can find it that way as well.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host. Gail Seiler and Susan Franson is also here with me today. Thanks to Dr. Megan Myers and the ISU students who spoke with us about Puerto Rico. And thanks to Bernard McDonald, who will be conducting the Central Iowa Symphony, and to our most recent guests from the City of Ames. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Evan Taylor. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. KHOI is a community radio station that is driven by volunteers and made possible by donations from individuals, businesses, and organizations. So please support KHOI. Just go to our website and look for the donate button.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show, which means you can be part of our team of volunteer producers and reporters. If you would like to join the team, contact us at 515-292-2878 or through our website, khoifm.org. And also remember, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Thank you for listening, and see
you again
on the radio.